Okay, a few announcements before we begin. Obviously, class is canceled for this week, so we will have to break down after class today. And although we don't specifically do anything for Christmas, we would like you know, to know that we love you, and we won't send you a card because that's too much effort. But we care deeply, really. And hope you enjoy your holidays. Okay, let's go ahead and make sure you're in fellowship. If that didn't get you out, or if that got you out, you can rebound now. And we'll continue on here, and hopefully maybe wrap this up today, and then be ready to do the doctrine of the importance of doctrine when we resume next week. We're dealing with Ecclesiastes 5 here, verses 19 and 20. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them, and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. Again, the reward is not so much a reward as a lot, an allotment, a portion. And to rejoice in his labor, or again, in the fruit of his labor, what it's produced. For this is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. So we stopped here with point 34, the fact this emphasizes that God retains sovereign control over every aspect of his plan. And we see that he allows some to enjoy their prosperity while others will not be allowed to do so, since they evidently lack the capacity. Again, either God is arbitrary and just smites one and loves the other, or there's some other factor that's involved here. 35, while some have said that this teaching undermines the traditional wisdom that life's pleasures can be earned by diligent labor, righteous living, and the pursuit of wisdom, it simply reinforces that already present divine perspective within the equation. So this reinforces the fact that, again, while unstated here, this man I see is the type of person that's happy, he's contented, he's accepted his lot in life. God has blessed him, of that there is no doubt. But he's not always apparently setting his sight on other things and all of this. He's happy and content within his niche. So 36, one should not emphasize the human element or the divine element exclusively when it comes to the issue of prosperity. They are complementary and function alongside one another. If one simply emphasized the divine element exclusively, he would logically just sit and wait for the gracious provision of God and never do anything. 2 Thessalonians 3 would undermine that. Verses 11 and 12, because believers are chided for not working. And one of the things you see, again, people tend to romanticize the Bible and say the age in which Paul lived, that it was somehow better than the age in which we live, and all of that, and it's not. That even in the Thessalonians were, by all accounts, a model church. But they had their share of problems too, apparently. They had some lazy people in their church that would not work for a living and wouldn't support themselves or their families, I guess. We don't know. But we do know they had problems, just like every local church has problems. And again, the only way to eliminate your problems in a local church is to eliminate STAs. And I don't think you're going to do that successfully. So verses 11 and 12, for when we hear that there are some among you leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. That is one of the inherent problems, of course, in a situation where people aren't working. They have too much spare time on their hands to get themselves into trouble. And they certainly get involved in, say, in acting like a busybody, worried about things that are not really within their purview, and all of that. So such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread. Paul doesn't encourage anybody to just sit back and wait and God will provide for you. That's the opposite of what he says. And then B, if one emphasizes the human element exclusively, he becomes anthropocentric. In other words, man-centered, works-oriented, and then misses the grace perspective. For instance, John 3:27 would tend to militate against that. So we recognize, and in many ways, there are these conflicting things in God's plan, which might appear to be conflicting, but again, are actually complementary. God's sovereignty and man's free will, they both exist. We are exhorted to be people of grace, but yet we have to enforce righteous principles. And that's, you have some tension that exists between that, how to be grace-oriented and righteous at the same time. That you don't just put up with anything, but you are still grace-oriented. So John 3, 27 here, John answered and said, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. Now he's talking again about, in context, about the fact that Jesus is the Messiah and that he is greater than John himself. But John recognizes the divine perspective in all of this. That Jesus is not this because he chooses to be per se, or this blessing doesn't fall on him by his choice, it falls on him by God's choice. And James 1:17. So again, you have to kind of maintain a balance here between man's part in all of this and God's part in all of this. James 1:17, every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. That God is consistent within the realm of light, within the realm of his viewpoint and all that. God consistently acts in a particular way. And this way, one of the things we see is his general attitude towards mankind is one of blessing. And God is certainly, we have to say, the most grace-oriented creature in the universe. And yet, God is going to do some incredibly, what people would think, harsh things to the human race. And yet, he's still grace-oriented. So, the harshness of God exists side by side with the grace of God. The sovereignty of God exists side by side with human abilities, human choices, and free will. So 37, unless one wants to attribute some form of arbitrary choice to God, this can only be the result of volitional responses to God and his plan on the part of those that have been blessed with prosperity. 38, why would God arbitrarily choose to bless one and frustrate another if all things were equal? That would be hypocrisy. That would be ever being a respecter of persons. If all things are equal, you've got to treat them both the same. That's what the Bible teaches, and we'd certainly expect God to live up to his own standards. If he wants us to live up to him, we would certainly expect him to. So the answer is that God is no respecter of persons. Therefore, he could not be righteous and capricious at the same time. Deuteronomy 10:17. And so God is, by all accounts, not a respecter of persons. So why, you have these two men that are blessed, and this poses a question. You have two men that are blessed, and yet one enjoys it, one has capacity for it, and one doesn't. And the difference lies in the man, not in God. God is the same. Deuteronomy 10:17, for the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who does not show partiality, nor take a bribe. And he executes justice for all people equally so. And so we can take that and say, okay, well then God couldn't just capriciously jam one, frustrate one, and bless another if all things were equal. So there has to be some differences here. The unspoken differences, I think, are kind of what govern these passages. Also Acts 10:34, where Peter got an object lesson in this, figured it out. In his presentation of the gospel to this Gentile household, I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality. But in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. That God is not, he recognized, of course, Peter was coming out of this Jewish focus that said God is only for the Jews, then the Jews only, and he hates everybody else. And the Gentiles he can't stand. And Peter's having to come out of this, having to cough this up now. And he recognizes that, wait a second, God's for everybody if they're righteous. That if they want to do his will, he's for them. So here he proclaims the gospel to Cornelius and his household. And they are saved just like the Jews were saved. And of course, Peter got no end of grief over this from well-meaning believers in Jerusalem who decided to take him to task. How dare you take the gospel to the Gentiles? They still were culturally biased, even in spite of all the things that, you know, the Lord had taught and all that. And this occurs after the stoning of Peter. Peter saw this thing, that there was no form of cultural bias with God. That God, his plan was expanding, as it were, beyond the boundaries of Israel. And in fact, his whole speech there in Acts 7 was still one of the most brilliant things. It took me a while to crack at what his points were. But his point was all about geography. He talked about all the great things in God's plan that happened, and none of them happened in Israel to speak of. He talks about Abraham and when he was called in Ur. Well, that's not Israel. And so all these things that happened, the things God did in Egypt, a lot of his great miracles, they weren't in Israel. And that's not to say that he never did anything in Israel, but he was pointing out to these people that the plan of God is going beyond Jerusalem and the temple out to the world, as it were. Well, that didn't set well with the Jewish authority, so they killed him. They didn't want to hear that. So again, Peter figures this out, as it were, kind of the hard way, and then gets taken to task for it by, again, well-meaning believers. And you can also see 1 Peter 1:17, which again documents that God is not a respecter of persons. 39, the fact that a man is empowered to eat from his prosperity indicates that he is enjoying a high level of living grace and has capacity to derive legitimate pleasure from that provision. The fact that he's prosperous indicates that he's got a high level of wealth. And the fact that he's empowered to eat indicates he's getting his legitimate enjoyment from that. And again, if you don't enjoy what you have, what is life going to be for? I mean, what are you going to have in life? Just misery? That's all you'll have. So here, point 40, that he is empowered to eat, to receive his reward, or more properly, to take up his portion, indicates that the man is oriented to God, the principle of grace, and has accepted and acclimated to the niche that he has been provided. And at some level, we all have to recognize, well, my niche is provided by God. He brought me into history at this time in history. You could have been born any time, as it were. I mean, when did God choose to give you life and live? Now. Here at the end of all things, as far as the human race is concerned. It's not the end for the positive, but you acclimate to that niche, whatever that entails, the good, the bad, the ugly. And, if you've done dumb things and you ride out a certain amount of discipline, that's a part of acclimating to God's niche. And we all have. And so you just have to learn like this guy, I think, and accept it. Okay, this is what God's provided. This is fine. And God provides more than we need. How many here had to miss a meal this week? Nobody? Oh, yeah. We all have plenty to eat, I think. I hope you do. If you don't, let us know. We'll gladly help you. So 41, he uses his prosperity wisely and limits himself to what is appropriate. He does not shortchange God or others as he freely enjoys his legitimate share of blessing. The fact, point 42, that he is empowered to rejoice in his labor indicates that he takes pleasure in the work that he does. Again, recognizing that his toil is an important factor in his niche. How many hours of your week are consumed with your job? And again, I think the emphasis here, as I've thought through this a little more here, as I did bring out in the next point, but your job is valuable. What do you do? You say, well, my job's not that big a deal. But yet the world at a certain level must need it, or it wouldn't be there. And so all of us do things, even small things, that are quite important. You know, some of it, you know, we're not all, you know, people work in the emergency room and save lives. Obviously, that's a pretty big deal. But, you know, I sit there and do spreadsheets. Not as important as saving lives, probably, but my boss is glad I'm there because he doesn't want to do it. So every aspect of anybody's work, I mean, there's a certain level, and you should derive some level of pleasure and satisfaction out of your job. So, again, work is valuable in and of itself. Whatever I don't aspire to be a garbage man, but I'm sure glad we have them, you know, when they haul off the trash twice a week. At least we get it twice a week. We're in the city. So here, 43, the term amal, here, toil or labor, is used to denote the actual work, toil or labor one performs. And further, it is used of the results of that toil, the fruit of one's labor. And 44, both may very well be in view here, since the wise person engages in his labor from the soul, i.e. Ephesians 6:7 instructs us to do your work from the heart, from the soul, literally in the Greek. And so you throw yourself into it. And if you can't throw yourself into your job and you can't enjoy it, for God's sake, go get another job. If you don't enjoy your work, that's a big part of your niche, you know, whatever it is, 30, 40, 50 hours a week, how many ever you work. And if that's what God provides, I mean, I'd pray about it. I wouldn't just lunge. But I'd pray about it, think about it. Okay, God, I'm not happy here. I don't want to do this any longer. Provide me something else, please. And wait and see what God opens up. But I'm not going to just sit there and wait. You know, I prayed about it, but I'm going to read the want ads too. That's the human aspect in it. See, I can sit there and pray all day, but if I never look, you know, when Jesus made those commands to ask and you will receive, to seek and you will find, knock and you will. See, you've got to ask, seek, and knock. You don't just sit there, say, oops, I found it. You weren't even looking. So, I mean, that would be a deal where I'd pray about it, I'd think about it, but also I'd explore what my options were. And then let's see what God provided. And he might provide nothing. I know one person, I've known him for years, they're just miserable. They hate their job. They hate their job, and they go do it every day, and they do nothing. I've known them for 20 years, and they just gripe about it all the time. They just gripe, gripe, gripe. It's one frustration after another. Well, why don't you, and I asked this person repeatedly, why don't you go do something else? Oh, I can't make the kind of money I'm making here. Is money that important? Well, apparently it is for this person. Apparently it's all about the money. Well, good grief, take a step back and do something you like. You're out of fellowship half the day because on your job because you're mad and you hate the job and you don't want to do it. Well, you're wasting a lot of time spiritually. You're not redeeming the time. And I tell this person, why don't you cut back? Why don't you, do something different? No, can't do that. I got all these bills God won't provide. Well, that person demonstrates, they don't have much faith in God. So you can't take a step back? What if you had to sell some of your stuff? Oh, I can't do that. So your stuff and your money is more important than happiness. Well, I don't think he's enjoying his niche. See, that would be the second person. He's not empowered to enjoy what he's got even. That's no capacity for this stuff. So, again, you do your labor from the soul. Do your job from the heart. Throw yourself into it. And do it right. And do it as a tone to the Lord. That means you look at your boss, and as far as you see him, he's the Lord. And you treat him just like you would treat the Lord. You do your job just like you would do if the Lord was standing there watching you. That's what it's about. It's what doing your job under the Lord. And he certainly enjoys what the hard work produces. If you work and you're diligent and God bless you, you're going to accumulate certain things. You're going to be blessed with certain things. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, the scriptures encourage it. But then you can't let it turn your head. That's the danger. You get focused on the prosperity and all that and keeping it and maintaining your little piece of the pie. Well, then you're going to just end up miserable like the person I was talking about. You're just going to end up doing your job so you make more money. And then you don't enjoy what you have. And I mean, if you're out of fellowship 30, 40 hours a week on your job, hopefully you rebound before you go to sleep and at least spend that time in fellowship. You're not getting any divine good for it. Yeah, I can rebound before I go to bed. Am I in fellowship? Yeah, but am I getting rewarded? No. I'm not doing anything. I'm not applying any doctrine. So, I'd rather sleep in fellowship, I suppose. So, 45, the singular demonstrative pronoun here is zeh. Refers back to all that preceded in the verse. That is, the capacity to enjoy the fruit of one's labor is a gift of God. And again, the question then becomes, why does God give this gift to some people and not to others? And again, I think the answer has to be volitional decisions and patterns in the life of the person. And we certainly know that some evil people are blessed, but do they even have capacity for it? Some very evil people have a lot of money. And when you see these riches of the richest people, the lists they'll put out every year, here's a list of the richest people, you're not seeing the list of the richest people by any stretch of the imagination. There are people with so much hidden wealth that they've got tucked away, the Rockefellers, the Rothschild family, these types of people, that they're never on the list. And believe me, they've got more money than Bill Gates does, a lot more. They just got it hidden in foundations and trusts and this and that and all that. So They're on there, but do they have any capacity for what they have? Or are they busy just still trying to accumulate more? Again, when is it enough? 46, Solomon continues his discussion of the believer that has capacity for life in verse 20, introducing some additional factors that exist in the life that enjoys a high level of blessing. 47, the New American Standard has done a good job of providing the translation of the first portion of the Hebrew text, which indicates that this type of person does not spend much time mulling over the past. 48, the NET, the New English Translation of the Bible, suggests that he does not spend much time reflecting on the transitory nature of life and the fact that death is certain. Therefore, the pleasures of life keep one's mind off its brevity. I mean, if you're enjoying life and you're having fun, let's say today, whatever you do, you're enjoying it and you have fun, you're not sitting around thinking about, oh my God, I'm going to die. We are going to die, but some people are sitting around and are consumed with that. They're so busy being consumed with either the past or the future that they never ever live in the present. And they never ever enjoy the daily gift of life that God provides. And they have no capacity for it. And these types of people are miserable. I don't like being around this type of person, frankly. To be honest, they're just miserable. So, again, if you're enjoying life, you're not worried about the past. You're not worried about the dying. If I'm enjoying myself, I'm not sitting there thinking, oh, I'm going to die. Stuart, the pastor up in St. Pete, came down Friday. We had dinner with him. I wasn't sitting there thinking, oh, God, I'm going to die while I was eating. I was enjoying, fellowship, company. 49, while that is undoubtedly true, the verse does not limit itself to a specific subject such as mortality. This verse encompasses much more than simply not thinking about the shortness of life. 50, this verse indicates that the believer with capacity for life, who is enjoying the blessings God has provided, does not choose to live in the past. 51, he is unconcerned with what has been done in the past. He doesn't spend much time rehearsing either the good, bad, unfair things or anything that's occurred to him. And I've met people like that. They just live in the past. That's all they can talk about. What's been done to them? God, I hate being around people like that. They are oppressive to me. Get over your bad self. Everybody's had bad things happen to them. Sit around and feel sorry for yourself. Does that make you happy? It doesn't make you happy. And that kind of person is just miserable. Do you think they're enjoying life? They're not. In fact, as they mull over it and get bitter and hostile and keep rehearsing the past, they're probably creating health problems for themselves. And we know that there's a certain correlation between, again, certain mental attitude sins and health problems if you engage in them consistently. And that's the thing that eats a believer's lives. They're not happy with their life, even if they got a lot. Because they're busy remembering how wrong they've been done. Well, everybody's been done wrong. So what? Get over it. Get over your bad self and move on. So 52, his mind is focused on the present and where it is leading. He is occupied with the blessings of his present life and doesn't have any desire to rehearse the past. And 53, those that brood over the past, and that's why I chose this word intentionally, they brood about it. They mull it over. They're like a dog with a bone. You can't get it away from them. And they're just going to consistently chew it over and over and over again. The same old stuff. The stories you've heard a dozen times, you're going to hear again from them. And at that point, God, I've heard enough. Shut up. Please. They focus their mental energies on things that cannot be changed and that are really not worthy of one's consideration. The person that cannot forgive offenses but constantly calls them to mind and rehearses them manifests a deadly spiritual failure. Matthew 6, 14 and 15. And this is a sin that will do you in. I've watched people be done in by this sin. I've seen them. They're casualties now because they live in the past. And I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. I mean, and they're miserable type people too. They're just unhappy, very unhappy. So Matthew 6, 14 and 15. Again, if you forgive others their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. And the people that do this, when they rebound, it's not of any value because God's not listening. This is the only sin that I know of that you can't rebound effectively. Every other sin you can do, But unforgiveness, God's really got this high on his hit list. And how can, again, the inconsistency of believers who've been forgiven, in the parable, of course, you've been forgiven a $10 billion debt and somebody owes you 50 cents. And you're going to get your pound of flesh. You're going to make sure that they pay you. In that parable, of course, the guy, he goes out, you know, the king graciously forgives his debt. Now, how he amassed a $10 billion debt, I'll never know. But he did, apparently. And the king just forgives him. And he promises he'll pay it back. You can't pay back $10 billion. You couldn't pay it back if you had your whole life. So the king had no choice at some level. Either he's going to have to incarcerate him, put him in the gulag and work him to death. You know, make him a slave, essentially, or prison. Or he's going to have to forgive the debt. Mark 11:25 also. Whenever you stand praying, forgive. If you have anything against anyone, so that your Father who is in heaven will also forgive you your transgressions. And there's a gloss here, but most likely it was supplied by a copyist. But it's the same principle that's taught in Matthew, so even though it's a gloss, it's probably the principle, the point is still correct. But if you do not forgive, neither will your Father who is in heaven forgive your transgressions. It's the very same principle taught in Matthew. And again, there was a parable about the guy, and I don't remember where it's at now right offhand, but again, the guy would not forgive. The king forgives him, and then he goes out, and it says he grabs the guy by the throat and starts choking him and tells him, pay me what you owe me. I've been forgiven $10 billion, but I can't forgive you 50 cents. Well, that is so inconsistent. And I can understand why God's got this pretty high on his hit list. B, the person that longs for the good old days of their youth. Them is, you know, I've heard people say, I like to go back and relive my teenage years. Oh, God. The angst, the teenage angst. You want to go through that again, huh? First, that's not very bright. And I remember those were some of the most miserable years of my life. You know, you fall in love and a girl breaks your heart and you're going to kill yourself. Or a boy. And all that. Pass. So, again, they demonstrate that he's maladjusted to the present and doesn't have capacity for this current life. Matter of fact, Solomon's going to chide people for that. As he's coming up there in chapter 7, he mentions that. Chapter 7, verse 10. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. This isn't a part of God's plan for you to be continually living in the past. So see, those that retreat into the events of the past do so likely because they have no life to enjoy in the present time. And no capacity for it, for what's going on, so they live in the past. And indeed, I love this quote when I found it, so I had to put it in there. People who live in the past are generally afraid to compete in the present. I've got my faults, but living in the past is not one of them. There's no future in it. Sparky Anderson was a manager for the Cincinnati Reds, by the way. So I thought that was funny. There's no future in living in the past. That's well stated. I couldn't have put it any better myself. And generally when you do something like this, you know, if you quote somebody, you should give them credit. You shouldn't just put it, I shouldn't put it in here and just say, oh, these are my words. You're supposed, that's called plagiarism. And you weren't allowed to do it in school, and you shouldn't do it in your doctrines or Bible classes. You don't plagiarize. Somebody says something, you know. Now, somebody has a thought and you reword it and put it in a different way and all that. Well, that's different. But I'm talking about a direct quote where you just pick a quote out and put it in there. So 54, in short, this explains a lot about a man whose life passes by quickly. Not because it's short and meaningless, but because he is so utterly absorbed in living it. And I'll have to be honest, for all the goods, the bads, the highs, the lows, and all that, it's been a fun ride for me. I've enjoyed it. But I don't spend a lot of time living in the past. I don't spend a lot of time agonizing about the future. I try to be wise and look ahead and apply some doctrine, of course. I've made doctrine the focal point of my life and stuck with that. And I've been confronted with all kinds of reasons to throw in the towel. Anybody that tells you they haven't wanted to throw in the towel on some occasions is probably lying to you. I think if you ask any pastor worth his salt, have you ever wanted to quit teaching, every one of them would say, yep, sure have. And but for the most part, life's been good. I feel like Joe Walsh there. Life's been good to me so far. My Maserati does 185. They took my license and now I can't drive. Well, that's not exactly capacity, but you know. But that's the whole theme of the song, is life's been good to me so far. And to recognize that life is good, God's good. And it's all not just misery and gloom and doom. There's fun to be had, there's enjoyment to be had, there's pleasure to be had. And if you're a contented person and you can have some capacity for this, you can enjoy life, or you can go through it miserable. You're going to go through it one way or the other. I would just as soon go through it, happy and contented. Now, I'm not saying at every level, at every point in my life, I always have been, but I'm just talking about in the general, overall, big picture, if you kind of evaluate your life, how's it been? And certainly, I attribute all of this to doctrine, to getting with the truth and sticking with it. No matter what the tests are, no matter what the challenges are, you just get there, you hang in, you keep your nose to the grindstone, and you just do your job, and you keep plugging, you just keep walking. And God obviously blesses that at a certain level. He certainly has blessed me. And no, I'm not filthy rich, but being filthy rich was never my goal. That never was my goal. The goal was to teach doctrine at a high enough level to get believers to maturity. That was my goal. And so you pour yourself into that, and I found it to be a very, it can be frustrating at times, don't get me wrong, but I found it to be satisfying overall. There's the study and the teaching, dealing with believers, and that's not always fun. The shepherding's probably the least fun aspect of it, but it's part of it goes with the territory. You have to make hard decisions sometimes, decisions you don't even want to make, but you're forced to. And if you do this thing right, there's blessing to be had in all of this. So again, I found myself, pretty well absorbed in just living life. It's been pretty fun. And again, it's not fun every minute. I'm not giddy. Do any of you think I'm just giddy? Is giddy the word you would use to describe? Well, let's not think of the adjectives you might use to describe me. But I'm not just giddy. I'm not insensible about it. I'm like some game show winner. Oh! Jumping up and down. Thank you, Monty. Monty. Let's make a deal. Well, but... No, I'd rather enjoy life than to just endure it. There's two kinds of people, those that enjoy it and those that endure it. So, and I suppose there's everything out there in between at some level. So Solomon, point 55, introduces his explanation as to why this fortunate man does not spend his time in the past with the conjunction key. Because, in 56, the last part of the verse has generated some discussion, which largely focuses on how we are to understand the hifil participle of ana. And that is, God keeps him occupied. That's the way the word is translated, occupied, in the New American Standard. And now again, the verb itself refers to an activity that keeps a person physically busy and mentally preoccupied. Most often the related noun refers to a task or an occupation, what you do for a living. So 57, the term is used in the cow stem with the basic meaning of a response. And the root is most frequently translated as answer, that word there, that they've translated occupied. But really the root, the fundamental root meaning of it in the cow is, and again, sometimes that's one of the struggles at some level with the Hebrew language, is that a root may have one meaning in one stem, and it may have a different meaning in another stem. And you have to be sensitive to that. Now, a lot of the lexicons, have done, the work is largely done. And you also have to be sensitive to context. That's another whole deal in the teaching. You've got to be sensitive to the context in which you find it, because a word may have a general meaning, but he may use it in context to mean something else. And again, you have to also be sensitive to the fact that there are homonyms. Words that are spelled alike but sound alike are spelled differently and have different meanings. These are spelled differently, but red and red. The color red, and then I read the book. They don't mean the same thing, obviously. So again, and in some cases, the root meaning may not be what the meaning is in the Hifil stem, say. So you have to be sensitive to that. So 58, however, there is apparently another root, a homonym, spelled the same way, but having the meaning of being busy with something, being occupied with something, or being afflicted by something. Some translators go for the fundamental root meaning of answer here. God answers him with gladness of heart. God responds to him by providing, we would say, by causing gladness of heart. And clearly the blessing of the Lord, as we know, makes rich. But not just physically rich, but obviously there's some mental riches and wealth that go with this. As we saw there, again, the man who is pleasing in his sight, what does he get? Wisdom, knowledge, and joy. All the intangibles that are very important, critical, in fact, to life, to enjoying life. Well, 59, while some have opted for the meaning afflicted here, I'd have to reject that and go with either answer or I certainly don't see the verse saying God has afflicted him with gladness of heart. That doesn't seem to fit the context. Afflict me with gladness of heart. No, I'd have to go with answer or occupied. And 60, the only difference between answer and the meaning occupied is that the former focuses on God's response to the man in view. That would be God's response to him, while the second focuses on the man's occupation with his life. And in 61, given the context in which Solomon is offering an explanation as to why the man does not choose to live in the past. And we can also add to this, I don't think he lives in the future either. I think he's busy enjoying life here and now, as it is. I don't think he's a Pollyanna on the one hand, you know, not the big bird, la, 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 but he's a realist. It's easy to fall into cynicism and pessimism and all of that, given the nature of the times in which we live. There's a lot of things to be cynical about, but you can't let that consume you. You know, or you're just going to end up as a cynic, and that's not a good thing. So he has to live. He doesn't live in the past. He doesn't live in the future. He's not, you know, trying to. I don't think at this level, from what I've seen in here, I don't see that he's doing anything other than enjoying his life. So it would seem that it is because he is occupied with his present blessing. And why do some people choose to live in the past? Because they're not blessed now. They're frustrated. They're miserable. God's jamming them. And so they choose to live in the past for whatever reason. And obviously, if life's not fun for you now, and it has its share of difficulties and all that, nobody's immune to it. We all get tested. We all have issues with which we have to deal. We all have to fight the STA, and I know that's not fun every day. But it beats capitulating to it, because once you capitulate to it, you're done. I mean, you're finished. And I would rather fight, you know, than to just give up, quit. Some people just give up and quit. They don't keep fighting the good fight. Okay, well, we're finished there, so we will stop here today. It's a little early, but I'm not going to dive into the doctrine. So we will be ready to continue here next Sunday with the doctrine of the importance of doctrine. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. We pray that God the Holy Spirit will continue to enlighten us. In Christ's name, amen.